Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
I guess it's you and I flying without Greg today, although he indicated he might be on.
Well, he's missing out. We got some good stuff today.
We have a busy week in aviation. Busy week with mishaps and in misadventures. Maybe it's a better way of saying it. So why don't you lead us into the events of this week, or some of the events of this week.
Certainly. Let's talk about the most recent one, which happened this past Saturday on in Boston. There was an aircraft taking off, a American Airlines, I believe it was a A319, and another aircraft landing, a Delta 737-800. And unfortunately, some messages got crossed because there was a near event, what the FAA calls a runway incursion. The American Airlines was taking off as a Delta was trying to land, and apparently the Delta crew executed a missed approach, and they came within about, by my estimates, about 850 feet from each other. Way too close than it should have been, and this generated quite a bit of press coverage. And John, you've have extensive experience with this particular airport. What are some of the issues with Logan that makes this, how should I say it, a challenging airport, even for professional pilots?
And not only pilots, but controllers as well. So every runway at this airport crosses another runway. So there is no runway that you can take off clearly without having a potential risky situation. So they all cross another runway. And because of how busy this airport has come, a number of years ago, they decided to split some of the duties between the air traffic controllers by cutting the airport up geographically. And if you listen to some of the tapes, you can see that there's two different controllers controlling different pieces of the operation right down to the ground. So they need to be coordinated themselves in what they do. And I think this is a good example of where that coordination broke down. But it's not the first time this type of event has happened in Boston, involving two different controllers. So that's why we went to it. Information is still a little bit hard to come by at this point in time, but it clearly is very similar to other events that we've had involving controllers at Logan Airport.
And this is an event that will likely be investigated by both the FAA and the NTSB. But I was able to get some preliminary information using some publicly available data. And I created a graphic that illustrates how close these two aircraft came. And if you look at these three lines, the sort of U-shape line at the top is the distance slant range between the aircraft that was airborne and the one taking off. And you can see that the minimum occurred when they were only about 800 or so feet away from each other, sort of like 600 feet horizontally, excuse me, vertically, and 500 or so feet horizontally. This is way too close. This is close enough where if you were on the right side of the airborne airplane, you would have clearly seen, in my opinion, a airplane on the runway under you, which would have made the average passenger a bit nervous. Now, this is just preliminary because we don't know exactly what was known in the cockpit of both aircraft and in the controller stations, or for that matter, who was talking to whom and when, and whether or not one or both aircraft were executing a proper request from air traffic control. Again, this is something that will have to be figured out, but it is clearly something that is going to be a high interest item because looking at the FAA's website, they have four categories of runway incursions. And this event, in my opinion, is going to be in one of the top two categories. A category which basically says the top one, if it weren't for the actions of someone in the process, this could have resulted in, let's say, a worse outcome than what we had.
And I tried to find out before the show if the NTSB was going to investigate it, and I was unable to get an answer officially. But I've heard unofficially that they were going to get involved. So I don't know. I wouldn't put any faith in what I just said. It's unofficial, and we'll have to wait and see for the official word from the NTSB if they're going to get. I'm sure the FAA has been gathering all the information they could. I was told that.
And we had a couple other newsworthy events in the last few days. There was a crash of a skydiving aircraft in Missouri, south of Kansas City, where it was an aircraft model, a single-engine turboprop, that had a number of skydivers on board, I believe 11 skydivers and one pilot. And they crashed near the airport. And this is something that's being investigated. We don't know a lot of the information about this right now. And we should have on the screen, a picture of the aircraft, which kind of looks like a Cessna Caravan, single turboprop engine, created by a company out of, I believe, New Zealand. And so this investigation will probably have participation from the New Zealand government and any representatives from the manufacturer from New Zealand. But this is not the first time that we've had, in the last few years, a skydiving aircraft crash with many people on board. And it's unclear what might have transpired. I looked at recent flights of this aircraft, and this was an aircraft that regularly did this sort of flight, taking off, going up to around, I don't know, 10, 12,000 feet, and coming back down, fairly quick flights. Why no one was able to escape, that remains to be seen. And whether or not this aircraft had exceeded any of its any of its limitation remains to be seen. The only information I was able to find is publicly available ADS-B data from places like FlightAware, and it gives you the ground speed, but it doesn't give you the airspeed. And certainly, we don't have anything like a black box or the equivalent from inside the aircraft that shows what sort of stresses or what sort of speeds the aircraft was experiencing during this flight.
You know, there was some discussion on the news media, referencing eyewitnesses that possibly a structural failure of the airplane. And, some of these airplanes actually exceed the limitations after they unload the skydivers, because they dive out of the way themselves. And sometimes they exceed the limits of the airplane. I'm not saying that's the cause of this one. I'm just saying that has been an issue for quite a while. While I was at the board, we had many discussions about this, about the way that the airplane gets out of the way of the skydives. They want to get down on the ground as quickly as possible to take another load up. So, and that's, that's how they make their money, is how many trips they can make bringing people up to jump out of the airplane. So all of that's going to have to be looked at by the NTSB, and they will, because this has been on the NTSB's radar for 30 years that I know of. So it needs a good sharp look this time, because we might have some good information out of this airplane. That was not always the case in previous accidents involving skydiving.
And the last of the recent events was a recent crash, which happens to be the first fatal crash or first fatal accident involving a NetJets aircraft. This was we have the aircraft there on the screen. And of course, I forgot what the model number was. This was a Cessna 680A that was flying from Cabo San Lucas to Austin. And there was some sort of issue as it was nearing the Texas border, and the crew made an emergency landing on a highway in or near Laredo, Texas. The initial reports said something to the effect of they had a fuel issue. I said to myself, this is a NetJets aircraft, very likely flown by two very experienced pilots, because NetJets, as many of you know, is one of the largest, if not the largest, operator of executive-type aircraft around, used by executives all over the world to do short notice flights from point A to point B. And Cabo San Lucas to Austin is not going to be something stretching the capacity of this aircraft. And very likely, if this aircraft were properly loaded with fuel, it would have had enough fuel to get to its destination, divert to another airport, be able to fly around for 45 minutes on top of that with plenty to spare. So saying that they had an issue as they were approaching Laredo, it doesn't make sense. That said, there's some pictures out there on the internet that shows people jumping into action. using hand tools and whatnot to break out the cockpit windows. Only one person on board the aircraft was killed. Everyone else survived. And so hats off to them for whoever these folks were taking action at a moment's notice when that action was needed.
Well, it's interesting to listen to some of the other podcasters out there, you know, other usually captains or pilots that are very quick to come with a conclusion, even though we don't have a lot of data. So there's been a lot of people speculating online that they ran the airplane out of fuel. It's way too early to say that. It is a possibility, but I think it's a very remote possibility. I think we may have either fuel leak, could have had a fuel leak, and we could have had a bad fuel gauges. Because very often, the people who fuel the airplane will use the fuel gauges, not necessarily stick the tank. They'll say, give me 300 gallons, 150 a side, and that's what the fuel does, and the fuel doesn't care what the gauges say. He was just putting that amount of gallons in the airplane. So it's going to be interesting to see what method of fueling they did. It's down in Mexico, so I'm sure they're going to have to talk to that person that fueled the airplane to see what he did or she, and then also what kind of interface did they have with the flight crew. But I'm not ready to jump all over the flight crew yet, because there's fuel quantity issues, fuel leak issues. You know, NetJets has a limited number of mechanics on their own payroll that works on their airplanes. They usually contract it out. And in fact, I think one of the major FBOs does a lion's share of work for them. I know that that's the case in a few airports that I've had worked in. In the recent past, in the last 5 years or so, I know that NetJets uses local facilities to do a lot of the work. So we don't have enough information ourselves to make a judgment, and I really wish that some of these other people that are on these podcasts would take a minute and before they open their mouth. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I still have a burr in my saddle about the one particular so-called captain expert who was blaming pilots without regard for the family or anything as far as factual, just making a determination himself based on very limited information and blaming the pilots. And it's premature. It's premature. Yeah, it could be the pilots, but why are you doing it without adequate information? Just because you can speculate? We try to avoid that. Do we get caught with speculating? Sometimes we do. But we try to avoid it like the plague. We try not to do that.
Well, one thing I won't speculate about is what happened at the end of the flight. Whatever the pilots may have done or not done beforehand, the fact is they were able to put the aircraft down on a highway, and not some 8-lane or 10-lane highway. This was a 2 or 3 lane highway near the airport. And all but one person was able to survive. And one can tell from the photos from the site, there was a post-crash fire. I'm not going to say it was a fuel-fed fire or what have you. And the aircraft did break apart. The rear part of the aircraft was sitting at some distance from the rest of the fuselage. So this was a very challenging landing. They were able to execute it. Sort of reminiscent of what happened a few years ago in Florida, where an aircraft had issues. And they put it down on, I believe it was Interstate 75, with a lot of traffic on it. And three of the five people on board survived. All the passengers survived. Both pilots, unfortunately, perished. So those are two examples where a pilot or a flight crew of an executive jet had an emergency situation, were able to put the aircraft down, and had at least some of the people on board survive.
Yeah, it's unusual. Normally, this segment of the industry has a very safe record. As you said in the beginning, this is the first fatal accident NetJets had. NetJets has been a company that has really paid attention with procedures. They have a pretty good, and I've actually looked at it, they have an SMS program to get information out of their pilots and their mechanics that they act upon. So it is one of the better operators in this country. So it is unfortunate that they've had this. I just hope the NTSB just holds to their own procedures and runs this one to ground, because this one might not be, you know, the obvious is you ran out of fuel. They might have to do some real heavy lifting to figure out why the fuel was down there, especially if it was a case where the airplane was, or the engines were using more fuel than they should have, or dumping fuel because of a leak. So it's going to be a little bit challenging for the NTSB to get through there. So it's going to take not only the NTSB's expertise, but also the expertise in their maintenance department as well, to try to make sure that there was no procedures in fueling and maintenance that needed to be modified.
And we're going to move from one fuel event to another fuel event, specifically episode 333, which we published earlier this year. This was the one titled Student Pilot Runs Out of Fuel. And we had a question from one of our listeners, one of our viewers there, Inclined to Fly, where the comment they had was, he or she admitted to being a former FAA and NTSB investigator, who in that person's experience found that many of the times a pilot claimed an engine failure was actually fuel exhaustion. And this person, Inclined to Fly, said, it's better to admit it rather than to deny it and maybe face an enforcement action. And John, you told me right before we went to air that this is something you've seen, that if you admit to something, FAO will go easy on you.
Yes, it has happened many times before in my experience, where if you admit that you made a mistake with the FAA and help, and maybe even do a safety seminar for them or whatever, the certificate action may not be taken. They'll still record it, but they may not take any punitive action against you or your certificate. It's not the first time. But you know what? I have a bigger concern here, and that is I don't know that all of these are being reported. So I think everybody here knows, I know you know, Todd, and I think everybody that listens to us know that I'm always hopping on pre-planning before a flight and a good pre-flight, and then putting your head on the swivel at the end. So as I'm going through accidents lately, and I've been going through quite a few the last several weeks, getting material for future shows, and I recently found a newspaper article. It talked about an airplane that ran out of fuel and landed on the highway. And I went digging to the NTSB, and there was no record of it. And then I went to the FAA and started digging, and there was no record of it. So now I went back and started to check different pieces. In the article, it mentioned that the police were involved. And guess what? The police did come involved. This airplane was on its way home. It was close to its home airport when it ran out of fuel, landed on a highway, no damage, no injury, nobody on the road. Or very early in the morning. It was a night flight, but daybreak was just breaking. And apparently, and this, you know, this is verbal pieces that I picked up, so there's no real record here. But apparently, the police took one of these pilots to a gas station where they got some gas, maybe to the airport, that's not clear, where they got some gas, back to the airplane, gassed the airplane up, and then the police blocked the roads on both ends where the airplane was and the direction it was taken off, and they flew the airplane back to the airport. And I got to thinking about that. I wonder how often that happens. You know, if you're out in Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, in fact, the middle of the country, virtually everywhere, even in Ohio, Indiana, where there's a lot of farm country, that's very easy to happen. Now, if you're a stranger in Oklahoma, would the pilots do that for you? I don't know. But if you're that close to your home airport, that's a different story. That may actually be something that happens from time to time. So I would ask our audience, if they know of anything like that, similar to that, let us know. Just by curious. Way, John,
you actually were reading the mind of our listener, Richard Turner, 6278, because for the same show, he had the question, how could this incident fly under the radar, basically not be advertised? Well, you just gave the answer. Circumstances are such where it doesn't enter into the record. By the way, some things are reportable events. If you do serious damage to an airplane, other things aren't. They're voluntarily reported. And this is something I say all the time. You come across something like this, or you're involved, where it was a close call, no harm, no foul, write a report, send it to the Aviation Safety Reporting System at NASA, which is running this program on behalf of the FAA, and the rest of the community can learn from your near disasters. I use the database all the time, and I'm always finding fascinating things which give insights into events that didn't quite result in an accident, but did result in some educational value.
Yeah, I actually did the fuel, and I don't want to say it by memory because I might make a mistake. But anyway, we know how much fuel he took on that he bought and paid for, and then just did the numbers because he did a multiple stop. He was building time at night and getting checked out. So we know the flight time, and he actually used a little bit more than what he took on. Not a lot, just a little bit, maybe 2 gallons. Right, so that calls into question how much fuel was in when he fueled it up. Did he make a mistake and maybe look at the gauges instead of sticking the tank and assume that a quarter tank was 4 gallons? Well, I'm just picking that number out of the air, but just assume the number that because the gauge read a quarter tank and added fuel accordingly. That's not an acceptable behavior. You've got to double check. You've got to be sure. Not assume. You know, we all know what happens when you assume something. And so you can't do it. You've got to take your time and do it right.
Now, this feeds into a question that came from episode 331, can AI improve aviation safety? And we had a listener, a viewer, Charles Furling 4382, whose comment was, I'll play along. AI will fly the jet before it can rig the flight control unit. And the implied question there was, what are some things human can do around aircraft that AI really can't replace? Let me just say right off, taking a dipstick and checking your fuel tank, that's one thing AI can't do.
Right, there's a whole bunch of them. Checking your oil, right? Doing the visual inspection on your airplane, you know, prop damage, you know, looking at your tires, making sure they've got the proper air pressure in it. The list goes on and on and on. Right? AI can't do any of that. Right? They also, AI can't fly the airplane, but it can help you a little bit with information, but it can't fly it. And one of the, in my presentations, one of the things, and both Greg and I say this, right? What if Sully, who used to work for US Air, and I worked for US Air, so we've crossed paths many times together. What if it was just AI on that airplane, was flying it? AI would have tried to get that airplane back to the airport because it may or may not had enough energy to do that, either Teterboro or back to LaGuardia. But the point is that, and Sully said in some statements afterwards, he was thinking ahead about where he's going to put the airplane down. And if he turned to go back to LaGuardia, there's nothing but houses and buildings and, you know, private residents and high rises between where he was and back to the airport, never mind making the impossible turn. And the outcome would have been different if he tried to go back. In fact, he recognized that early on because of his training. You may recall that his, very early in the transmission to the tower, they were trying to push him back to either LaGuardia or divert him over to Teterboro, and he clearly said unable. He said, we may be in the Hudson. So he was already thinking about how much energy he had left and where he was going to go. And this is by memory as well, so it may not be 100% accurate, but I kind of remember that he went over the George Washington Bridge at approximately 900 feet, and the bridge height where he went over was 850 feet. So that was pretty close for a no-engine airplane. So it it's
one of the things I tried to. Whoops, sorry about that. One of the things I tried to do with this particular question is, let me use AI to basically illustrate the promise and the problems with AI. I thought, okay, AI, give me a something that illustrates the relationship between human questions and AI conversations. We have a nice little fancy graphic here. However, it can only do something like that based on the information it has available. If you don't put the information in ahead of time, either in your question or in its data, it can't answer the question. Like John just said, unless you put into the AI's brain all the various combinations of bizarre things that could happen, when a bizarre thing happens, it might not be able to give you a good answer. In fact, it probably won't give you a good answer. So yeah, AI is a great tool. Heck, I use it for this graphic. But it's not a tool that replaces decision-making. It's not a tool that replaces experience. It's not a tool that replaces judgment. That is still a very human capability.
Yes. And unfortunately, we don't always behave the way we should in making those assessments. You know, the number of airplanes I see running out of fuel in events that get reported, it's scary. It's scary.
Well, our last question for today is not AI related, but it is related to the LaGuardia event that happened a few weeks ago from episode 326, which is called What Really Went Wrong at LaGuardia Airport. We should have a graphic here that shows basically the aftermath, which unfortunately was fatal to the two pilots. And Rob T. Pym 62, should the temporary closure of a runway involved in an active emergency response be treated as a standard preventive measure? As many of you recall, there were fire trucks that were approaching the runway when, for whatever reason, a fire truck entered the active runway and the landing aircraft hit the fire truck. But I was wondering out loud, looking at his question, is this going to be unnecessarily disruptive if you make a standard practice of whenever there's an emergency vehicle or something crossing the runway, you close the runway?
Well, I'll tell you that I was involved in a couple of them. So I was involved with an airplane that had an accident in the middle of the country. I think it was St. Louis, but I can't remember exactly now because it's 30 years ago. But anyway, so we had an event. Two airplanes collided on an airport, and that airport continued to operate. And they were landing airplanes on the runway that this one airplane just turned off of. And they had passengers that evacuated the airplane wandering around the airport. They came down the slides and went out, and they were scattering, getting away from the airplane. Absolutely crazy. And the NTSB, I was on the board at the time, we issued some rather pointy comments about the operator of the airport and the folks involved for allowing that to continue. And it's not just something in the United States. I was also involved in one in Italy, very similar, and they continue to operate as well. So it's almost like the controllers are having tunnel vision. They got all these airplanes that they're trying to get in and get out, and they're just using different pieces of the airport to do that. All right, so it does happen. Controllers make mistakes. They get, just like pilots, just like mechanics, dispatchers, you get focused on the issue, and you just keep on going. And without thinking about the negative consequences of continuing. I think it should be standard operating procedures when you have an emergency that you just stop, let everybody take a breath. Doesn't mean you can't start it up again, but just do a pause. You know, a minute, 2 minutes, let everybody get their minds back on the whatever job they had and digest additional information. And then continue on.
Well, let me ask you this, John. I know that the NTSB and the FAA have very different roles when it comes to things like this. NTSB is all about safety. They do not consider the operational, rather the profit or revenue aspects of decision making, whereas the FAA has a job of regulating air traffic as well as promoting aviation. What kind of pushback would you expect from the FAA and its lobbyists saying, hey, you know, we should close down the runway completely if it means your airplanes are going to go and do a missed approach and maybe spend a few more minutes in the sky. Safety is paramount. Do you think the FAA would say, yes, we agree with this, or would there be a fight?
No, I think the FAA would, if whatever feelings they have, they publicly, they're going to not fight that issue. The one that will fight that issue is the airport themselves, because their revenue depends upon those airplanes taking off and landing with their, with landing fees. So they're going to be concerned about that. Maybe not the CEO of the airports, but people below them. They want to keep the airport open, keep the airport moving. You know, don't want to inconvenience hundreds of passengers, or maybe even thousands. So there's a lot of moving parts in that equation. And I tend to look at things solely from the safety point of view. And, you know, the fact in that one accident that I said where the passengers came down the slides and were running all over the airport, the trucks, emergency equipment, wasn't even there yet. And these people were running around the airport, and they were on the edge of the runway where other airplanes were landing. So it's crazy. You have an event, you got to pause. But send everybody go around, you know, manage the holding patterns until everybody else gets their act together, and the situation is firmly under control. So it's crazy. It's crazy to do that. You know, LaGuardia is a busy airport. And, you know, nobody wants to send those airplanes around the holding pattern while they deal with the United airplane that had the initial emergency. But this is the consequences when you try to push too many airplanes with too many other events going on. You know, you got the emergency airplane, you got all kinds of equipment. I mean, we talked about it a little bit. I've been looking at some of, in the past, I looked at some of the radar and the pictures of the airport proper with the equipment that was running because of that emergency. Man, there was tons of equipment moving on, which I expect from an airport like LaGuardia. They have a lot of equipment. So you expect them to have everybody all hands on deck. We're trying to get out and deal with this emergency. But in the meantime, the controllers are still pushing airplanes in on the same runway that the airplane just turned off of. We need to figure out a way to make a safe pause until we figure out, you know, it might only be 5 minutes, but just do it so that everybody gets a chance to take a breather, assess what's going on, and then crank it up again if the need arises, if it can be done safely. So, and LaGuardia is a very compact little airport, so it's probably a bigger risk at LaGuardia than it is at JFK or other airports.
And with that, I think it is time for us to start thanking everyone involved in the show. I'd like to thank, of course, you, John, for giving your contributions, which, again, your wisdom is appreciated by based on the fan mail we get. And also I'd like to thank our major host of EMCO, which has been supporting our show for the entire time we've been up and running. And they offer all sorts of insurance products for aircraft owners and operators. And, you know, check them out. If you don't have them already, check out what they have to offer for you. And also, I'd like to encourage our audience, who are our members, to send us questions. FlightSafetyToTexas@gmail.com is the place to go if you have any questions about this. Not just the folks who are watching us live, but eventually the show will be on our regular podcast. Please do so then. Also, sponsors. If you are willing to be a sponsor, getting your product or service in front of our audience, we want to hear from you. FSDsponsors@gmail.com is the place to go. We will listen to every reasonable opportunity you give us. And also, we'd like to tell those folks who are watching us for the first time, join us. You can subscribe, you can join as a member, and get benefits such as early access to shows and access to the live show you're seeing right now. Well, those of you who are seeing it live right now are already members, but those who are not seeing it live, become a member. You can be part of this group here. And all of you, you can like us, you can write good comments in our shows, and if you're a YouTube member, that's how you get the early and premium content. And also, share this video with anyone you think that might benefit from it, or anyone who thinks that you think might like to hear our perspective on aviation safety.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.